All right, so today we're diving deep into a fascinating case out of the Connecticut Supreme Court, State v. Allen.
Yeah, this one's really interesting.
It is, it is. We often see how these state-level decisions can sometimes reflect or even diverge from federal legal principles.
Exactly.
And this case is a prime example of that. It really gets into the nitty-gritty of how Connecticut approaches conspiracy, especially when it comes to drug offenses.
Especially with narcotics, yeah.
And how drug dependency factors into the equation.
Right, which can be a very tricky area.
Absolutely. So specifically, we're looking at Section 21A 278B of the Connecticut General Statutes.
That's the one with the heavier penalties for those who aren't drug dependent.
Exactly. And, for our listeners who are really trying to understand the nuances of criminal law in Connecticut, this case is a must-read.
Oh, absolutely. It's a great study in statutory interpretation and how those interpretations can have huge impacts on case outcomes.
Huge, yeah. And we've got some great resources to help us break this down.
Yeah, we do.
We have a detailed legal brief. We've got the standard case summary
Always helpful.
and some really interesting internal guidance that kind of helps us see how the legal arguments play out.
Yeah, it gives us a good peek behind the curtain.
It does. It does. So our mission today is to unpack all of this, make sure that our listeners, you folks out there, can grasp the core legal principles that are in play here
That's the goal.
and why this case is so significant, especially when we're talking about conspiracy charges.
And that whole burden of proof issue.
Exactly. Who has to prove what when it comes to drug dependency?
Exactly.
So let's start at the beginning.
Yeah. Good place to start.
Can you tell us who is Nehemiah Allen and what landed him in court in the first place?
Sure. So Nehemiah Allen was convicted on two charges. First, conspiracy to sell narcotics.
Ah.
And this was specifically under that section we mentioned, 21A 278B.
One for non-drug dependent individuals, right?
Yeah. Yes. And the second charge was interfering with a police officer.
I see.
Sounds like he had a bit of a run-in with law enforcement.
So, what happened? Did the Connecticut Supreme Court agree with these convictions?
He did. They affirmed both of Allen's convictions, actually upholding the decisions of both the trial court.
So they went along with the original rulings
Exactly.
and the Connecticut Appellate Court.
So it went all the way up the ladder, and the decision stood.
Wow. Okay. So take us through how this case moved through the courts.
Well, first there was the trial.
Right.
Jury found Allen guilty.
Makes sense.
Then he appealed to the Connecticut Appellate Court,
Yeah.
arguing, of course, that the conviction was wrong.
Standard procedure.
But they upheld the trial court's decision.
Okay.
Still not satisfied, he then appealed again, this time to the Connecticut Supreme Court.
Right. The highest court in the state.
Right. And as we said, they also affirmed the lower court's rulings.
Wow. So three strikes.
You could say that.
But there's more to this, right?
There is. Even after all that, Allen filed a motion claiming his sentence was illegal.
He didn't give up.
He did not. And he based this on some pretty big Supreme Court precedents, cases like Allen v. United States
Ah, okay.
and Apprendi v. New Jersey.
Now, those are landmark decisions regarding sentencing.
They are. But ultimately, this motion was also denied.
So even with those arguments, no luck.
No.
Interesting. But let's back up for a second. What exactly were the facts of the case? What led to these charges in the first place?
Okay, so the conspiracy charge, that stemmed from evidence suggesting that Allen was involved in more than just a single drug deal.
So not just a one-off transaction.
Right. The prosecution presented evidence of collaboration, suggesting a coordinated effort to sell drugs.
So working with at least one other person then.
At least one other, yeah. And it suggested a broader agreement, a plan that went beyond a simple buyer-seller interaction.
More organized operation.
Yeah, that was the implication. And something else that's important to note here is that Allen never presented any evidence at trial suggesting he was drug dependent.
Interesting. So that factor wasn't part of his defense strategy at trial.
Not at that stage, no.
Yeah.
But when it came to sentencing, the trial court did take into account Allen's prior convictions for narcotics offenses.
So his past history with drugs was relevant for the punishment phase.
Absolutely. And as for the charge of interfering with an officer, that came about from, well, an altercation with law enforcement during his arrest.
A bit of a struggle then.
Seems like it.
Okay, so we have the background. Now let's get into the legal weeds, starting with the conspiracy charge.
All right, let's do it.
Allen argued that he was just involved in a simple drug deal, not a conspiracy.
classic defense.
He even brought up this federal concept of a buyer-seller exception.
That's a key point.
Can you explain what that exception is and why it didn't fly with the Connecticut Supreme Court?
Sure. So, in federal law, the buyer-seller exception basically says a straightforward drug transaction between a buyer and a seller without anything more.
No strings attached.
Right. Doesn't automatically equal conspiracy.
So just the act of buying or selling isn't enough to trigger a conspiracy charge at the federal level.
Exactly. Adams is essentially arguing, look, I sold drugs to someone, that's it. No big conspiracy here.
Keeping it simple.
Right. But the Connecticut Supreme Court wasn't persuaded. Their reasoning, Connecticut's own law regarding conspiracy already requires more than just a transaction.
So the state law is stricter in that sense.
It is. In Connecticut, you need proof of an agreement between two or more people to commit a crime.
Okay.
Plus an overt act that furthers that agreement.
So there has to be that extra step, that action taken to carry out the plan.
Exactly. The court basically said, we're already addressing the concerns behind the federal buyer-seller exception with our own law.
So they saw it as redundant, unnecessary to adopt the federal principle because Connecticut already has a similar safeguard in place.
Exactly.
So if Connecticut law already demands this element of an agreement, what evidence convinced the courts that Allen was part of a conspiracy rather than just a single sale?
Well, they pointed to evidence of repeated collaboration between Allen and others in selling narcotics.
So multiple instances of working together.
Right. There was evidence suggesting they were planning sales together, even splitting the profits.
A clear pattern of working as a team.
Yes. And the key point here is, even a single transaction can be grounds for a conspiracy conviction in Connecticut.
Really? Even just one sale?
If there's enough evidence to demonstrate that coordinated effort, that agreement to work together for a criminal goal beyond just that one isolated sale, it all comes down to proving shared criminal intent and the agreement to act on it.
So it's about the bigger picture, the context surrounding that single transaction.
Precisely.
Okay, let's move on to the second major legal issue in this case. Drug dependency.
All right, let's dive into that.
Allen argued that whether or not he was drug dependent should have been something the state had to prove.
He wanted to shift that burden of proof.
Or disprove, I guess, since the charge was selling narcotics as a non-drug dependent person.
Right. He wanted it treated as an element of the crime under Section 21A 278B.
But the court disagreed, right?
They did. They disagreed. And this gets to the heart of how we interpret statutes and the really important difference between elements of a crime versus affirmative defenses.
Legal jargon alert.
I know. But bear with me. It's crucial. The Connecticut Supreme Court stuck with its previous ruling in State v. Ray.
An earlier case that set a precedent.
Exactly. In that case, they'd already stated that under Section 21A 278B, not being drug dependent isn't something the state has to prove.
So it's not on the prosecution to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is not drug dependent.
Right. Instead, the court said drug dependency, in this context, is an affirmative defense.
Okay, now I'm really lost. Can we break that down? What's the difference between an element and an affirmative defense, and why does it matter who has to prove what?
Of course. It's a fundamental concept in criminal law, and it really does matter. So an element of a crime is a fact that the prosecution absolutely must prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
If they don't prove it, the defendant can't be convicted.
Exactly. If they fail on even one element, the whole case can fall apart.
Makes sense.
Now, an affirmative defense is totally different. It's an argument or a set of facts that the defendant has to prove.
So even if the prosecution does their job, proves all the elements of a crime,
the defendant can still walk free if they successfully prove their affirmative defense.
Wow, okay.
In the context of 21A 278B, the court has basically said the state just has to prove the conspiracy to sell narcotics.
That's their primary job.
Right. If they do that, then it's on the defendant to raise and prove the affirmative defense of drug dependency.
And that could then affect sentencing.
Absolutely. If they prove it, they might be sentenced under a different statute, 21A27A, which doesn't have the same mandatory minimums tied to non-drug dependent status.
So it can make a huge difference in the outcome.
Huge.
So in Allen's case, he didn't present any evidence of drug dependency at trial.
He did not.
What did that mean legally?
It meant he didn't raise that affirmative defense properly.
Didn't check that box.
Right. So the state didn't have to disprove it.
Because it wasn't even on the table.
Exactly. It all goes back to who has the burden of proof. In this case, it was Allen's responsibility to prove his dependency, and he didn't. So the court treated him as not drug dependent for sentencing under 21A278B.
Ah, so because he didn't meet his burden of proof, he faced the harsher penalties.
Unfortunately for him, yes.
Okay, so we've got the elements, the affirmative defenses, the burden of proof. Now, let's get back to those big Supreme Court cases Alan brought up, Allen and Apprendi.
Yeah, those were big swings.
What was his argument there? Why did the Connecticut Supreme Court ultimately reject it?
Well, his argument was focused on the fact that being not drug dependent under Section 21A278B triggered a mandatory minimum prison sentence.
Ah, I see where he's going with this.
Right. He claimed that based on Allen and Apprendi, that non-dependency should have been treated as an element of the offense.
Something for the jury to decide.
Exactly. You see, those Supreme Court cases basically say that any fact other than a prior conviction,
okay,
that increases a mandatory minimum penalty for a crime,
mm-hmm,
has to be treated like an element of the crime,
okay,
presented to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecution.
So he was trying to use those cases to force the state to prove he wasn't drug dependent?
Exactly. But the Connecticut Supreme Court said, nope, not so fast.
They didn't buy it.
Nope. They reiterated their stance. Drug dependency under 21A278B is an affirmative defense, not an element of the crime.
So those federal rulings about elements didn't apply here because Connecticut had defined dependency differently.
Precisely. And they even quoted from the standard brief, which stated, under 21A278B, drug dependency is an affirmative defense that must be proven by the defendant, not an element of the offense that must be proven by the state.
So they drew a clear line, element versus affirmative defense.
Very clear. And because they saw it as an affirmative defense, those mandatory minimum penalties tied to non-dependency didn't fall under the Allen and Apprendi requirements.
So the Connecticut Supreme Court's interpretation of where drug dependency fits within the law was absolutely crucial.
Absolutely crucial, yes.
It determined how they applied those big Supreme Court decisions.
Exactly.
Now, we know Allen also made a separation of powers argument.
He did.
He challenged the prosecutor's ability to choose between charging someone under Section 21A278B or 21A277A. Mm. Can you walk us through that argument and the court's response?
Sure. So Allen basically argued that by letting prosecutors choose between those two statutes,
one with the mandatory minimum and one without.
Right. The state was violating the separation of powers principle.
So he felt like the prosecutors had too much power.
In a way, yes.
Yeah.
He argued that it encroached on the powers of the legislative and judicial branches.
Interesting. So what did the court say?
They rejected the argument.
Flat out.
Yeah. They said that deciding what crimes to charge is a core function of the executive branch. In this case, the prosecutor's office.
So it's within their purview.
They emphasize that this kind of prosecutorial discretion, deciding what charges are appropriate.
Right, using their judgment.
Is constitutionally permissible.
Okay.
And it's not overstepping into the judiciary or legislature's territory.
So the court basically said, prosecutors have this power, and it's not a violation of the separation of powers.
Exactly. And we even saw this reflected in the guidance materials.
Right.
They summarize the court's reasoning as, charging decisions are core executive functions. It's not judicial overreach. This preserves flexibility in addressing drug crimes.
So maintaining that balance of power is important, but so is giving prosecutors the flexibility to handle these cases appropriately.
Right. Plus, the standard brief points out that the court leaned heavily on its previous decision in State v. Evans.
Another case where this issue came up.
Right. They basically said that the separation of powers questions raised by Allen were essentially the same as those already dealt with in Evans.
So they saw it as a settled matter?
Yeah. The brief actually quotes the Evans decision directly, saying, we conclude that our examination of these same issues in Evans thoroughly resolves the claims in the present appeal and that there is nothing in this case that would mandate a different result.
So they're saying, we've been here before, same principles apply.
Exactly. And it continues, quoting Evans again, the jurisdictional issues raised by the parties and the merits of the underlying arguments presented in this appeal are identical to those considered in State v. Evans, Supra, 329 Connet, 770-189-A3D-1184, which we also decide today. So it's pretty clear that the court considered this issue already resolved within Connecticut law.
They weren't interested in revisiting it.
Ooh.
All right, so let's wrap up this deep dive into State v. Allen. What are the big takeaways our listeners should remember?
I'd say there are a few key points. First, This case really highlights that state courts don't have to follow every single legal doctrine from federal courts.
Like the buyer-seller exception we talked about.
Right. If their own state laws already address the same principles, they're good to go. Connecticut felt like its existing conspiracy law already covered those bases.
Makes sense to them.
Right. Second, it shows just how important statutory interpretation is. Where a certain fact, like drug dependency in this case,
right,
is placed within a statute.
How it's defined and categorized.
Exactly. Has huge legal consequences. Who has to prove what? What constitutional rights apply? It all comes down to that initial interpretation.
So lawmakers need to be incredibly precise with their language.
Couldn't agree more. Third, it reinforces that those landmark Supreme Court cases, Allen and Apprendi.
The ones about increasing mandatory minimum.
Right. They specifically deal with facts that are considered elements of an offense, not affirmative defenses as defined by state law.
So the distinction matters a lot.
A lot. And finally, the case shows the court's deference to the executive branch's power to make charging decisions.
Giving prosecutors some leeway as long as they stay within the bounds of the Constitution.
Exactly.
So State v. Allen is a really important case for understanding Connecticut's legal framework when it comes to narcotics conspiracy and how it handles drug dependency in sentencing. It clarifies the interplay between state and federal legal approaches and firmly establishes that in Connecticut, it's the defendant's job to prove drug dependency under 21A278B if they want to avoid those harsher penalties.
Absolutely. And for anyone involved in the legal world in Connecticut, it serves as a reminder that the structure and language of a statute can have far-reaching effects.
Yeah, the devil's in the details.
From the initial charges, the evidence used at trial, all the way to sentencing, and what constitutional protections apply.
It all traces back to that initial wording.
It does.
Wow, that's a really insightful analysis. I appreciate you walking us through all of that.
My pleasure.
So for our listeners out there, let's leave you with a thought to ponder.
Okay. Given this ruling in State v. Allen, what are the strategic implications for defense attorneys working on drug cases in Connecticut? How do they decide when and how to present evidence of drug dependency? And what does this case tell us about the ongoing, sometimes complicated, relationship between state and federal law as criminal law continues to evolve? Lots to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into State v. Allen.
Thanks for having me.
We'll see you next time.
See you then.